This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Gone are the days, ladies and gentlemen, I'm afraid, when we can somehow imagine that the situation is not as bad as our scientists say it will be, nor that the consequences are so far off in the future that we need not worry. Like a sleepwalker, we seem unable to wake up to the fact that so many of the catastrophic consequences of carrying on with business as usual are bearing down on us faster than we think, already dragging many millions more people into poverty and dangerously weakening global food, water, and energy security for the future.
Welcome, welcome to a full helping of warnings, despair, good humor, and one man's example to the world. I'm Alex Smith. With so much audio, we must orient and load up quickly. Direct from the alternative presentations at the Rio Plus 20 conference, you will hear two short speeches on the economy that's never counted, and the assault on a new science of planetary boundaries. Independent environmental journalist Stephen Leahy sent us the exclusive audio of Kate Raworth and Johan Rockström in Rio. Then we'll journey to Australia. The self-sufficient John Morgan tells us about his 9-star energy-efficient home that needs no furnace or air conditioner. Plus, a look at Australia's new carbon tax, coming into effect July 1st. But first, a group of 21 scientists from very different fields of study produced a special briefing for the journal Nature. That was ahead of the meeting of world leaders in Rio de Janeiro for the second Earth Summit. They concluded our planetary home could be heading for a massive shift, a new state not seen for millions of years. It's spine-chilling, so I'll need to call on my radio sidekick for this program, none other than Charles, Prince of Wales.
There were basic perceptions to overcome, particularly public awareness of climate change, which was lamentable to say the least. Which is why, despite countless such meetings and gatherings ever since, the increasingly dire warnings issued by yourselves and others around the world that we are rapidly breaching one planetary boundary after another have been consistently and alarmingly ignored. At the moment, there is a dangerous, fundamental disconnection between scientists, the public, and the private sector. It is dangerous because it blocks so much progress on the ground, partly due to the fact that too few people believe, or are discouraged from believing, what the best of our science is telling us, and partly because they do not relate that troubling global picture to their own isolated situation and behaviour. Which is why I cannot stress enough that any action from now on must have as its ultimate aim the goal of integrated thinking. Not only do we need to connect each individual's concern with that of the Earth's, we also need to forge an economic framework that is just as joined up. We can ill afford any more to let things operate in separate silos within individual disciplines. Thinking must be integrated, just as policies must be integrated.
That is from Prince Charles as he addressed the Rio leaders by video link on June 19, 2012. Charles demanded scientists and other experts come out of their silos to assess what is really happening in the world. That is exactly what did occur when a group of scientists were organized by the Berkeley campus of the University of California. We go now to one of the participants, Arna Moores of Simon Fraser University. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm here with Arna Moores, and we're going to be talking about one of the more shocking, I think, papers to come out in some time. It's talking about the possible catastrophic impacts that could happen if we just continue on our way with climate change and other ecological impacts. So we are pleased to have one of the 21 co-authors, I believe it is, Arna Moores, and he's from Simon Fraser University. And I'm just going to ask you first to explain, if you will, the broad general context of what this paper is about.
Sure. Thanks for having me. So the context, one context is the Rio Plus 20 Summit, which is ongoing. And in preparation for that, a group of researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, decided to hold a meeting where they invited people from all sorts of different disciplines in biology to cogitate on sort of interaction connections between climate change and biodiversity specifically. And this group invited mostly theoreticians, so it's more conceptual people, to see if there was anything that would bubble up that had been overlooked or was being overlooked or required some more focused attention. And this review, which you refer to, which is called Approaching a State Shift in Earth's Biosphere, came out last week in the journal Nature, and that's what we're talking about today.
All right. Now, a shift. What sort of a shift are we talking about?
Yeah, so what is a state shift? So one way of thinking about it is that you can project into the future, and you can do sort of straight line projection and say, okay, well, this is happening, and there's a small change here, and there's a small change here, and we're going to be able to predict what's going to happen by adding up a bunch of small changes. A state shift is where, if you're kind of graphically minded, you can think of it as where the line stops being straight and does a huge jump up or jump down or jump somewhere else, and you move into a completely different regime. And the different regime we're talking about is a different global regime, so that the way that the ecosystems are organized now will completely change and you'll get new organization. That's one way of thinking of a state shift.
And you had to employ some really different methods to come up with this. I mean, can you describe some of the different fields that were drawn together for this project?
Yeah, so yeah, when you say different methods, I mean, this is a sort of a review by induction, I think if I have that term right, where we were looking at examples from lots of different fields and asking whether we could draw some generalities from those examples from those different fields. So we had mathematicians who model toy ecosystems and then perturb them and see if they undergo state shifts. We had ecologists that look at food webs and then model those food webs and then say, okay, well, what happens if this, you know, we have this species go extinct? Well, how does the food web react? Is it stable or does it completely fall apart and do new food webs result? We had a lot of paleontologists who had been studying how the Earth has changed in the past, and they've actually seen global state shifts. And we had evolutionary biologists, people who are geneticists, all coming together to have a look at how climate change and biodiversity are connected. And we came up with some, I don't want to say they're surprising, all of the independent patterns that we talk about have been documented many times and by people who are much more expert than the people that were there. But we tried to ask whether we should think of them together, if we consider them all at once, do we get something different? So when you say different methods, I think it's different patterns at different scales. We're all collected together, and then it was really just, we're just making a plausibility argument. We're saying this is, you know, something at the global scale could happen because of the things that we're doing, because of the things that we see in other contexts, at other times, at other scales.
So we're not just talking about climate change here. We're talking about things like where we just take over the land that former species were there, or we wipe out mangrove swamps, or all those things are included?
Right. So that's one of the major issues. So we have this overriding climate change, which is occurring incredibly rapidly. And then you layer on top of that some of the other things that humans are doing. So one is the extinction of a lot of biodiversity and the particular parts, you know, top predators, for instance. We have land conversion, so we're now have converted to use for us over 40% of the entire Earth's surface. That's cities, agricultural land, you know, mining, dams, infrastructure. And we've also pulled a lot of the total amount of energy that the Earth takes from the sun and turns into food. We've actually sequestered for ourselves, so somewhere between 20 and 40% of the entire net primary productivity is actually being used by us. That's one species. And all three of those things that we are doing on a global scale are the sorts of things that can cause state shifts in ecosystems at smaller scales and at other times.
Well, you know, you talk about species extinction, and I've been hearing some terrible statistics about that. It seems to get worse as time goes on. And yet, when I talk to people in the public, it's like, well, okay, we're missing a few snails or a beetle somewhere or a couple of flowers. What difference is that going to make? So how did the extinction process work into this paper?
Well, that's a good question. I think, to be fair, in this paper, we simply bring it up as one of these pressures, one of these things that's happening on the global scale, and it's something that we have to think hard about. We do know, so the interesting, maybe one interesting factoid is that the paper just after ours, in the same issue of the journal Nature from last week, is entitled Biodiversity Loss and Its Impact on Humanity. And there they go into some detail how the loss of species, both locally and globally, can have severe impacts on ecosystem services and ecosystem function. So we just refer to that, to all that other work, and say we know that when species go extinct, big changes can happen. And I can give you one example where it's not just a few snails or a few flowers, but if you look at the cod fishery on the east coast of North America, particularly the east coast of Canada, there's a case where we overfished the cod, so pulled out a top predator from the ecosystem. And even after we stopped and thought that, okay, the cod will come back, they didn't come back, and the whole ecosystem has changed. So that's a state shift that's occurred regionally in that fishery that was caused by the loss of a particular species. And there are lots of other examples of that.
Well, it seems to me, too, that timing is everything. I've spoke to some paleoclimatologists, and we've talked about these changes in deep time. They're sort of fuzzy timescales. Was it over 100,000 years, or was it over 10 million years? It seems to take a long time in many of those cases. Now we're talking about something that happens very quickly because of us. And does your paper contain some indications about the timescales that we're looking at, how quickly things could happen?
Yes, we do discuss that at least a wee bit. So a couple of interesting points that we bring up in the review include the fact that the last global state change, which was the shift from the glacial to the interglacial that happened somewhere on the order of 10, 11,000 years ago, the more we study that particular state change, which was dramatic, of course, because we went from being underneath kilometers of ice to being able to grow banana trees here, up here in Vancouver at least, that could have occurred very, very quickly, on the order of maybe even 1,000 years where most of the change took place. So we do have examples where global state changes can occur very rapidly. And then layered on that, we have the observation that the rate of climate change now is faster than the rate of climate change has been globally for a very, very long time. And when I mean very, very, we may have to go all the way back to the end Cretaceous, so the asteroid hitting the dinosaurs, where we can pick up a rate of change of global climate that's as fast as now. It's been warmer before, of course, we're actually in a fairly cool period, but we're talking about the change from year to year in temperature. So both of those things suggest to us that these sorts of state changes can occur over short periods of time, because they have, and we may be pushing the system even more than it's been pushed in the past. I mean, remember, this is just speculation. We have we hope we're wrong, and we have absolutely no idea whether a global state change is even possible. Well, certainly possible, but whether it's probable. But we have no idea when it would start and how long it would take.
All right. So then what is really the purpose of doing this project and of doing this paper? And I want to try and get in this word catastrophe. There is a whole viewpoint of science, of catastrophism, that it actually is a valid science. It's not just something that the radio people whip up or newspapers. Sometimes very strange things happen in nature fairly quickly. So were you trying to measure out whether that is possible, and would you use a word like that?
So I would say that the people that came and wrote this paper would not be not all of those people would be the ones that you would ask about something as specific as that. I think the point of doing this was to raise awareness and focus people's attention on the possibility. So instead of just doing a straight line extrapolation, we feel that people who are studying land use change and energy movement through ecosystems, extinction, climatologists should get together and see whether it's possible to make some quantitative predictions. And because it's a state change, because it's one of these things where everything goes topsy-turvy and you move into a new state, prediction is, of course, very, very difficult. But what we do know, or I shouldn't say we know, but what we're fairly confident in saying is that if the Earth was to go through a state change it would be very disruptive. Because the last 10,000 years have been some of the most benign, predictable years in Earth's history. And that's not a coincidence. The reason that we've been able to develop as a species, socially and technologically and all the rest, is in large part due to this predictable, benign climate in which we've found ourselves. So you can build a city and know that it's going to be there 100 years into the future. So I think it's about focusing people's attention and saying, look, this might not be true, but we should find out. And so I don't think any of the people who came to this meeting were catastrophists. So we certainly went into the meeting open-minded. This came out of the meeting. It wasn't going into the meeting. People, we discussed all sorts of things we thought might be important. And this just seemed to be the one that we thought required attention now. Because if it's right, it's a big deal.
Well, yes. And I think one of the important points that you've raised, and the example of the cod contains it, is this idea of a state shift that you're not going to go back. I think that a lot of the public, and myself included, have thought, well, all right, we'll bring the CO2 somehow down to 350 again. Things will go back to the way they were. We'll all return to the way. But no, some states, you just never can go back.
That's actually one of the things that I hadn't realized either until I got into this, is that it's called hysteresis. It's a technical term, but it's exactly that. As soon as you start getting drawn to this new state, you cannot go back. Even if you remove, if you try to put everything back the way it was, it's too late. The system is just flipping over and becoming something else. And I think you're right. That's one of the things that, again, if we can make that clear to people, then it might lead to some more focused attention. I mean, I say that with lots of caveats, because what scientists say and what scientists know often has very little to do with what happens in the world. one can only hope.
I know. And, the Rio Plus 20, I've already had emails from various people saying that the back text is more or less finished, that the politicians are going to make their speeches, but it's just another paper or another large report, and we have so little action on it. So I'm wondering, do you see a future life for the work and the project that you've just done? Is it going to continue, or will the paper itself, do you think, get further out there and start people doing new work?
That's a very good question. I wish I knew. I think it will lead to new scientific work. I think that this kind of collaboration, where you have all these people who've never been in a room together, I don't expect people who study populations and study fossils and study plants and do math. And I hope that that there'll be other collaborations that may be even more focused on this topic. I mean, one of the major questions that we leave open is whether it's predictable. So are there telltale signs of a state shift? So there are sometimes in simple computer modeling and things, but can that get scaled up? Can we take climate data and can we analyze it in a new way where we might pick up some telltale signs that it is possible? Beyond that, as I just said, we've known about global warming since the 80s. The scientific community has known about it. And as you say, we've got Rio Plus 20, which is, I've heard the same as you, that it's just going to be another piece of paper.
Do you have any suggestions for people to follow up on this? Are there websites that you would recommend, or is it basically going to the publication Nature and getting it if you have a subscription? Or how can listeners follow up if they want to?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I have posted a version of the paper on my website, because obviously not very many people have subscriptions to Nature, and some of the other authors have done the same. I think that's a place to start. I mean, it is scientific review, so it is full of jargon. There's three or four papers in this issue, which is a Rio issue. It's called Second Chance for the Planet. There's three or four of them, and they're all very good. One's about population, one's about biodiversity, this review about climate change and state shifts. And that would give you definitely the sort of latest consensus on some of these issues. Beyond that, I wish I could direct people to places on the web that might have more useful information. That might be one of the things that would come out of this, would be places where people can go. So this just came out last week, and I think we're still sort of digesting how the public is responding, and I think there'll be some follow-up amongst the authors as to what we do next.
Well, Arne, I want to ask you to give us your website, if you would, and also send it to me an email, and I'll post it in my blog at ecoshock.info in case the address is long. But can you give us your website?
Well, the easiest is just to Google my name, Arno Morris, and you'll go directly to my website. But it's www.sfu.ca/A Morris.
Right.
Okay. I don't know, because I just Google myself and click on my lab site.
Okay, so that's A-R-N-E,
that's right?
M-O-E-R-S?
No, M-O-O-E-R-S.
Okay.
And if you just click through publications.
All right, so do that, folks, because this is one of the more surprising papers that I've run into in some time. And I will put links to Arna's website and to a Simon Fraser University press release about this that has some good facts and figures that sort of lead you into it. And then pick up a copy of Nature if you can, because there are some good things in it. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thank you for having me.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Before we hear two short speeches from the Rio Plus 20 conference, here is another brief clip from Charles, Prince of Wales.
Now, I have watched in despair at how slow progress has sometimes been and how the outright sceptical reluctance by some to engage with the critical issues of our day have often slowed that progress to a standstill. In this, I am forcibly reminded of Sir Winston Churchill's words of warning as the threat of a cataclysmic Second World War was being studiously ignored during the 1930s. He spoke against continuing with the strange paradoxes of being decided only to be undecided, resolved to be irresolute, adamant for drift.
In the campaign to stop or at least limit climate change, what about the economy? Why is Europe skirting collapse? What about the U.S.? Why are billions of people starving while the rich people dine sumptuously on the consumer buffet? Here is 8 minutes from Kate Raworth of Oxfam explaining her growing donut campaign at the Real Plus 20 Side Conference. We tune in just as she warms up.
What we need is in the shape of a donut. And I apologize for bringing junk food into the room, but sometimes you need to get a little bit silly to make everybody wake up and say, what are you talking about with a donut? So I'm going to tell you about the donut. But first I'm going to start 20 years ago. Not in Rio 92. I wasn't in Rio 92. I was very busy studying economics at university. And the problem with economics is quite a serious one, because anybody who studies macroeconomics, even just a little bit, will very quickly come into this diagram. It's the diagram of the circular flow of money and goods. And what you see going on is households provide their labor to firms who pay them back money. And with that money, they buy stuff and they get the goods. So the black arrows show the flow of goods and resources, and the red arrows show the flow of money. This is an incredibly simple diagram, but it is at the heart of every macroeconomics textbook. And the big thing about it is it goes right here into the back of the head of everybody who studies economics. So anybody who's a policymaker today working on economics, this went into their head quite a long time ago. And it goes in so subtly that you don't even know it's there. And the problem with it is, it's completely wrong. I'm going to tell you about three things that are completely wrong with this picture. The first one is, the economy is not floating on a white page in the middle of nowhere. Because it's only looking at, this economy is only looking at monetized resources, right? It's only looking at the flow of resources that get monetized. There's a lot of other resources that really matter to human life that aren't monetized. And the first one that we're all here talking about is the environment. The economy is not floating, it's based in the environment. And there's a flow of natural resources coming into households and pollutants coming out, and same with firms. And we ignore that at our own peril. If you say that to an economics professor, they say, oh, environmental externalities. You can go and do a special paper on that. It's not a special paper, and it's not an externality. It's the fundamental resource on which we depend. So we have to bring it right into the heart of economics, and that's what ACIM is trying to do. The second thing that's missing is the unpaid care economy. The extraordinary work that's performed by parents and carers, usually women, providing care for children, looking after sick people. But also, this woman has a bucket on her head, because across the world, millions of women spend futile hours of their day carrying water to and from their houses, carrying firewood, growing food that is completely outside the monetized economy. And yet they are providing the fundamental goods and services that keep their families alive day to day. They're massively subsidizing the industrial economy by providing all these things and preparing the workers of next generation. It's completely unaccounted for. If you talk about that, your economics professor will say, ooh, that's feminist economics. That's really strange. We don't have a paper in that yet. But if you ignore this, you're completely ignoring the incredible work of half of the world's population in developing countries. You're ignoring the work of every single person in this room who gets a child up in the morning, looks after them, raises them, gets them to school, and is producing the human capital of the next generation. So we have to bring the unpaid care economy into our understanding of economics. And the third thing that's missing from this diagram is that when firms give payments to households, some people get the wages and they're quite low, and some other people get the dividends and they've been rather high recently. And the Occupy movement worldwide has pointed out that the inequality that this is resulting in matters, that societies don't want to be extraordinarily unequal. We have to pay attention to if an economy is growing, how it's growing. If you take all of this away and go back to that picture, it's suddenly incredibly impoverished. And yet that is the picture that economists are getting putting into their heads. I got really frustrated with economics because of this. And that's why a couple of years ago, I was very, very excited when I saw this. Because to me, this diagram of nine planetary boundaries done by Johan and his colleagues, what I saw was where economists have refused to put the environment around the economy, the natural scientists have stepped in and done it for you. And they've had a go at quantifying it. So the green area in the middle is the safe operating space on all of those nine boundaries that we should stay within. And if you take that safe operating space, that might be safe in terms of an environmental ceiling, but we need to bring the story of poverty and human rights in here. So just as there's an environmental ceiling, so too there is a social foundation below which no human should live. Nobody should be in that blue area, because in that blue area, people don't have the resources they need to meet their rights to food, water, energy, incomes. They're living in inequality, ill health. We all have the right to the resources we need in life to meet those rights, but collectively, all 7 billion of us must do it within planetary boundaries. Surely this is the compass that should be guiding us in the 21st century. And it's shaped like a donut. And inclusive and sustainable economic development can only call itself that if it is indeed bringing us into this space. Just as Johan tried to plot where are we on the planetary boundaries, I decided to do the reverse on the social boundaries. And for all the metrics that I could find, all the dimensions for which I could find data, we are under the boundary. So 13% of people in the world don't have enough food to eat. 19% of people live without access to electricity. 21% of people are living on less than $1.25 a day. Humanity is falling far below the boundary. And when you put the social floor next to the planetary boundaries, this is the crisis we face. Millions of people still live below the social foundation, and we've already gone over the planetary boundaries. It's a sign of just how extraordinarily unequal this world is and how unequal the path of development we've been taking has taken us on this journey. So we need to get rid of it. We need to really bring this into the heart of the way we think. This needs to influence economics. So here's my guerrilla campaign. Everybody could just get their pen. I have to say, this is not Oxfam policy, just before I get in trouble. If you've got your pen, you sneak into the university library, you sneak into the bookshops, you sneak into the room of every economics professor you know, and you take your pen and you draw in the environment around this diagram. You draw in the unpaid economy and you draw in social inequality. Now just think what a favor you're doing to all those economic students, the 16-year-olds and the 18-year-olds who are just about to start studying economics. Because for everything that Achim is doing, everything that Johan's done, all the work on the natural capital and bringing it into the economy, this diagram is still what economic students will meet today. And it's going to get put right into the back of their heads. We have to change the fundamental paradigm of what we think the economy is if we're going to change the way we think the world should be run. If you're willing to go one step further, you could even rip that page right out of the book and stick this one in instead. Now imagine, You're here on the first day of an economics course. Welcome to economics. You want to be an economist? Fantastic. Let's not talk about money yet. Before we get there, there's a few things you should know about this planet. That it has planetary boundaries. You need to know a little bit of science first. And you should know something about its inhabitants. They have human rights. And it takes resources to realize those rights. Now, with that knowledge, your job as an economist is so important. Your job is to design markets and regulation and governance to bring us into that space between social and planetary boundaries. Now, if that's the way economics started, I would be proud to call myself an economist. It's the way we need to go. If you're interested in this idea, we've got a panel session on it first thing tomorrow morning, really dynamic panel. We're going to discuss whether or not we can put planetary and social boundaries into action. I'm blogging about it for Oxfam. There's the blog address. I'm talking about it on Twitter. So if you're into living in the donut, please join me there. Thank you.
That was Kate Raworth at the Rio Plus 20 conference. She was recorded live by independent journalist Stephen Leahy, who sent the audio directly to Radio EcoShock. Thank you, Stephen. Find him at stephenleahy.net.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. But wait, there's more. No doubt you've heard scientists, led by the Stockholm Resilience Institute, have compiled a chart of 9 planetary boundaries we must not cross if our civilization is to survive. It's sound science, now under attack by pollster Ted Nordhaus and the hostile misnamed Breakthrough Institute. We uncovered Ted and former Green crossover Michael Schellenberger in 2 Radio EcoShock specials back in 2007. See my blog at ecoshock.info for links to programs exposing these two, their alleged institute, and their funding. As Stephen was recording, Johan Rockström of the Stockholm Resiliency Institute, backroom dealers were stripping out any reference to planetary boundaries. Lazy leaders were quick to jump on the anti-science being peddled by the Breakthrough Boys. Anything to keep the killer society going. Listen in as Johan Rockström speaks in Rio.
Thank you, Virgilio. And I decided just 1 minute back to totally change what I'll be saying, because the wisdom has been so deep and vast here, so I have very little to add, in fact. So let me be more personal and say the following. I've been very unpolite up at this panel. You may have seen that I've been sitting a bit writing on this laptop. And the reason for that is that I'm totally bombarded by skepticism right now with regards to the planetary boundaries. So what's happening at Rio Center right now is that the planetary boundaries concept and science in general is being picked out of the texts. And one key reason for that is that a quite contrarian institute called the Breakthrough Institute released a report a couple of weeks back, led by Ted Nordhaus and a couple of colleagues, trying to argue that the planetary boundaries is just an ideological approach to change and top-run policy in the world. And we're being subject to a lot of attacks for that, and that's why I'm under tremendous pressure right now to try and, with scientific colleagues, and many of you are in the room, to just inform world leaders that the planetary boundaries analysis is actually based only on Earth system science, and just trying to answer one very simple question. If you took away human beings for just a little thought moment on planet Earth and just had our wonderful blue marble standing there on its own, and if it could talk to us, the question is, what are the Earth system processes of planet Earth that matters for the stability of the planet? And for each one of those processes, could we try to define a point beyond which we take a risk that the planet might bite us back, might cause accelerated change that simply are not conducive with what we call prosperity in the modern world? And can science today, thanks to its massive advancements in Earth system science over the past 30 years, in fact provide humanity with a quantification for each such process, defining a safe operating space, as Kate pointed out, as a very humble way of integrating science, communicating it to world leaders, and providing a new concept to guide prosperity in the Anthropocene. And what is then the Anthropocene? And this is where the drama starts of the planetary boundaries journey, because The plant demand analysis actually comes all the way back from Herman Daly's work, which I think clearly Kate has referred to in terms of the steady state economy, all the way to ecological footprints, guardrails, tipping elements. But what really started the journey was the evidence, which is not a 1992 evidence, it's actually an evidence that comes just over the past 5-10 years, showing that we've entered a whole new geological epoch, the Anthropocene, where we humans, anthros, are a geological force of change. The first time this is published as empirical evidence is in 2002. And the first real synthesis comes from the International Geobiosphere Program in 2004, showing, which I'm sure this room has seen, all the hockey sticks of accelerated change. You pick whatever parameter you want that matters from human well-being, they look the same. 1955, we put in high gear and pressures on the planet accelerate. Biodiversity loss, nitrogen overuse, air pollution, deforestation, climate change, you name it, they all look the same. So up until the mid-1950s, we had actually a very limited imprint at the global scale. But in 2011, in May, a whole group of Nobel laureates and leading Earth system scientists does a synthesis, reporting to the world that humanity has reached a saturation point in terms of its pressures on planet Earth, because beyond this point, we can no longer exclude tipping points that would undermine the ability for poverty alleviation and human prosperity in a world where we're basically committed to 9 billion people. Now, when we saw that research, we realized, well, what happens if you combine that with resilience theory, the theory that everything from a wetland to a savanna system to a marine system has multiple stable states separated by thresholds? And the interesting thing is that for the past 10,000 years, the Earth has been stable in a, for us, very, very supportive equilibrium. So all the biodiversity and all the beauty on the planet that we so much rely on for our economy has been established over the past 10,000 years in the Holocene. And if we're pushing ourselves out of the Holocene, and if we cannot exclude tipping points, we said, let's develop a new framework to guide humanity in that new situation. It was not there in 1992, but it's, as Julius pointed out, as Akio's point, it's all there today. There's simply no scientific reason for inaction, because it's empirical evidence that we're hitting the ceiling for so many processes. And that's why I and many colleagues with me become very nervous when this science is accused of being just some kind of ideological positioning, as if the biosphere was not absolutely critical for human well-being. So in a way, what I'm sharing here is just a plea as a pressed scientist among friends and colleagues of a prosperous, sustainable world to try and be very active during the coming week and help, I think, our political leaders, because many, many leaders want to act exactly on this agenda, but they feel a bit uncertain, you know, when suddenly they're getting, you know, mixed messages. And we all know about that strategy being used for climate, being used for acid rain, being used for the links between smoking and cancer. So that's just a complete off my, so to say, script here. Now, let me just come back to the script very, very briefly and just say the science is advancing all the time. One of the, you know, I won't walk through the 9 boundaries, but one of the most important boundaries, as Julia pointed out, is the one on biodiversity loss. And there's been a lot of discussion, is there really a boundary for biodiversity? And we took the leading biodiversity scientists from Diversitas and Terry Chapin and others, and really concluded that yes, we're in the 6th mass extinction of species, and we're learning more and more that biodiversity regulates the resilience at ecosystem scale that supports human economy. Now, you may have seen that the 7th of June, in Nature, there is a paper coming out, which is, in my mind, the strongest support for the plant abundance analysis so far, which is that we have growing evidence that biodiversity loss may be actually connected with a planetary-scale tipping point, that if we push loss of biodiversity too far, if we homogenize, if we make monoculturalize our nature too far, we may, in fact, tip over into new state at the planetary level. That's not the Planetary Boundaries team doing this science. This is colleagues outside critically analyzing what we suggested as a new approach of dealing also with biodiversity in this global situation. And my final point is the following. Surprisingly, the negotiations here, both the U.S. and the poorest countries in the world are questioning the Planetary Boundaries concept. Now, I can see why the U.S. is doing it, but I cannot understand why the poorest countries are doing it. Because just as Camilla pointed out in the beginning, you know, if we agree that there are biophysical boundaries at the global scale, then suddenly we must move into a just fair sharing of ecological space. It becomes the very absolute robust argument why, as Akin points out, the developed countries have to reduce their footprint, because if we are in a situation where we have to share one finite carbon budget, a finite phosphorus budget, a finite land budget, a finite freshwater budget, then suddenly it becomes clear that the right to development for the world's majority, that so far have caused and contributed very little to the Anthropocene, is absolutely fundamentally clear as an argument on the table. So I think it's a misconception that the planetary boundaries pose some kind of restraints on development. It rather provides a safe operating space for poverty alleviation. And I would very much like to see that discourse perhaps discussed in this plenary here. Thank you very much.
That was Johan Rockström of the Stockholm Resilience Institute speaking at Rio. And now, by the power vested in me by radio, I take you to Australia. In a recent Radio EcoShock interview with Dr. Guy McPherson, we learned maintaining a comfortable shelter for human bodies is a principal driver for the continuing use of fossil fuels. We create a lot of climate damage just to keep our homes cool in the heat and warm in winter. And despite a reputation as a coal-exporting country, Australia is stimulating better housing as a way to cut greenhouse gas emissions. With the farming industry and the fabulous barrier reef threatened, Australia has developed a nationwide house energy rating scheme. Our next guest is going to explain it and how he gained 9 out of 10 stars in his owner-designed home. John Morgan's Eco House is found in a rural area near Victoria in southeastern Australia. As we spoke at the end of June, John is dealing with the cold of the Australian winter. John, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, by way of introduction, John, just to give us a peek, how much do you pay for electricity every month?
Well, I don't actually pay anything, Alex, and that's because I generate all my own electricity by means of a well-designed solar power supply, which is built into and on top of the house itself. So I'm not connected personally to the national grid.
You are off the grid, and I want to talk about that solar power in detail. But first, I want to ask you, what made you decide to create an eco-friendly house?
It seems like I have generally had that kind of impulse going back quite some time. I suspect possibly early on, I'd found the idea of being dependent on others for things like electricity and water, which are, of course, the essentials of life. I found the idea of being dependent on others somewhat unsatisfactory. For example, you only have to have a major storm pass through a major city like Melbourne here in southeastern Australia. And as a result of that, many thousands of people can be without electricity for many hours or even a day or two in worst cases. This struck me early on as being a pretty unsatisfactory state of affairs. And that led me to look further into the matter. And I guess it was probably assisted by the fact that I worked as a teacher for a good many years, and the specialty that I used to do in the classroom was physics, electronics, mathematics, and things like that. So I was probably well primed to the business of looking into reliable and comfortable living. Once I started back in the 1960s, it more or less just grew from that. And over those years, I have designed and built 4 or 5 of ever-improving versions of this type of house.
And do you find the technology is getting easier to get to do what you want to do?
Yes, I am finding that, Alex. The technology is evolving in a great number of ways. And better still, the cost of this technology is actually going down.
Right, unlike most things, which are going up. I find it critical that you mentioned water use. I remember just a couple of years back when the choice was whether to deliver water to the major city of Adelaide or let farmers use it for crops in the Murray-Darling River Basin. And there's new regulations again last year in 2011 about how much the farmers can use. So it would be a very big deal if city dwellers used much less water. How does your house and this energy rating scheme accomplish that?
The key to success here, Alex, was that I have made the decision to ensure that I'm fully independent. And so it turns out that I'm living on a fairly large property. I'm outside of the town. I'm nowhere near an urban development at all. I'm on 20 acres. I'm on fairly close to the top of a hill. And the property is well exposed to the weather. And that means that, in effect, any water I need simply falls out of the sky. I have 136 square metres of roof space to collect it, and so every millimetre of rain delivers me 136 litres of water. This, of course, goes into storage tanks, and as of today, I have 40,000 litres of fresh water stored in two tanks. The situation with electricity is much the same. Every day, the sun comes up quite reliably, has done for billions of years. And even though a day like today, the radiation intensity is not much, the sun shines every day, and I have 3 kilowatts solar panel capacity on the roof of the house, and I collect current from these panels that gets stored in a battery which is inside the house. The battery is quite large. And as of this morning, I have at least 3 or 4 days of stored electricity in the battery that will see me out until the next bright sunny day turns up. So it works on that basis that I have structured the whole enterprise in such a way that it is fully self-sufficient. And the house itself has been designed in such a way that its electricity demand is extremely modest. For example, for the 3.5 years I've been here, the average daily electrical consumption is 5 kilowatt hours. And my solar array on the roof is well large enough to supply that with plenty left over.
What about heating when it gets cold? How are you heating the place?
That's the most interesting question of all, Alex. Because the house does not have an inbuilt heater. It depends upon the sun outside to shine in sufficiently to warm us up. But there's a little bit more to it than that, which I should explain. I have designed the house to make the most of the 3 well-known qualifications for good design. I refer to glazing, insulation, thermal mass. So what happens here, this house is designed as a brick veneer house with the brickwork on the inside of the house, whereas in Australia there is a long-standing custom to build a house with brickwork on the outside and then a timber wall inside with plasterboard or timber lining for the finishing. So I've gone against that trend. I've switched it inside out, so to speak. On the inside of the house I have masonry walls, and the role of the masonry walls is to store heat and to stabilise the temperature excursions that you might normally expect between hot and cold conditions. And so, at the moment, the brickwork on the inside of my home here has had a good amount of thermal energy embedded in it during the first 6 months of the year, during the warm period and then the autumn season leading into winter. The energy to do this comes from the sun. And I've arranged things so that the exposure of the windows to sunlight is able to optimise the intake of radiation, and we're able to build a significant amount of heat into the fabric of the building, which has the effect of tiding us over during the colder months. But on top of that, the real key to success is the fact that the external walls of the house, the outside timber frame walls, these are very heavily insulated. The roof of the building is also heavily insulated with something of the order of 8 inches of good insulation embedded in between the ceiling and the roof. The windows are all double glazed, and in the winter months like now, I have a set of screens made of one of the well-known block-out fabrics that I can attach to the windows internally and they act as an additional layer of insulation. So that turns what initially was a double glazed window into in effect, a triple glazed window. So I get radiation in from the sun, and I keep the energy that comes with that in the house by very heavy insulation. And oddly enough, it does work. I don't actually have a heater in the house.
No furnace at all?
No furnace at all.
That's probably the way we're all going to have to go eventually, especially as fossil fuels just get more and more expensive. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm talking with John Morgan about his super energy-efficient house in southeastern Australia. John, what about the cost? Is the Australian nine-star plan, is it just for millionaires, really?
Interesting question, Alex. With this particular house, I made the decision right at the beginning that this house would probably be seen as some kind of an example. And so I decided that I would spend no money at all on architectural features. I would design a place that was completely featuring the requirements of comfortable living and completely ignore architectural merit or anything of that sort. And so the place does not look much. I'm first to concede that. It's a little white box on the hill, exposed to nature's gifts in the form of wind and rain and sun. And as a result of taking this slightly down-market approach, I was able to produce a plan that was relatively cheap to build. Even after I added the cost to the house, the cost of the power supply, the standalone power supply, and the water tanks and all that goes with that, the total cost of building this thing in 2008 was somewhere around $165,000. Now, the Australian dollar and the US dollar are pretty much the same at the moment, so your listeners would be able to take that number at face value. And as modern housing goes, that is a very cheap building.
It is indeed. And, you know, you talked about not being dependent on the system, and it seems to me right now, I don't know about in Australia, but certainly over in Europe and here in North America, there's a lot of worrying economic news. We may be heading into a serious depression. We don't know, but you could sit that out with few bills to pay and still be quite comfortable. That would be worth more than gold to me. How do you feel about that?
Yes, I have given that matter some thought, Alex. It is clear that the commercial world is in a real shambles at the moment. You have the Europeans who are in a very bad shape in relation to the monumental debts that they have allowed to grow up. You've got the people of Greece, for whom I have great concerns because it looks like there's going to be widespread poverty in Greece. And it can't be ruled out that something similar is likely to happen elsewhere in Europe. I'm not very familiar with the Canadian situation, but I am aware that the Americans are in a fair amount of financial trouble with regard to their budget deficit. And you can see that the American economy is recovering, perhaps, but in very, very slow degrees. And the Lord knows how long it'll take for America to get really back on its feet. And so it's very interesting because one of the characteristics of this house that I've built here fits into this sphere of thinking. I refer to the fact that on the northernmost corner of the house here, Alex, I have a greenhouse attached to the main building. This greenhouse is useful for the process I described a little earlier of providing hot air that I can pump into the main building as the greenhouse heats up each day. But not only that, this attached to greenhouse I am currently using to grow vegetables and also seedlings for planting out on the property, which is essentially rather bare, 20 acres of bare paddock that was originally for sheep grazing. I'm trying to turn this back into a small forest, and I'm growing a lot of seedlings in the greenhouse for propagation onto the land when they're ready. But the primary thing is that I'm growing food in the greenhouse, And although it is in its early stages yet, my planning goes along the lines that I will be able to produce a significant amount of fresh food for regular daily consumption in the house, adding even further to the independence issue and relieving somewhat the strain on the financial resources needed for survival. So although it wasn't planned in that particular context, the self-sufficiency thing that we're doing here does augur well if the crunch were to really come.
Right. It certainly can't hurt, and you will get the best food you can get. Instead of getting it from the industrial system, you can grow it yourself. Well, as we wrap up on this idea of a 9-star house, I've heard Australia also becomes the first country to implement a nationwide carbon tax as of July the 1st, is it?
I think we're not the first. There are carbon pricing policies in existence in most parts of Europe. In fact, I think many of the American states are doing it. I think California, for example, which is a fairly major economy in America, California has a viable carbon pricing scheme. They do tend to vary. Here in Australia, the carbon pricing policy comes into operation in about a fortnight. It begins officially on the 1st of July, and it's a very interesting mechanism, the way it's designed to work. It has sometimes been referred to here in Australia as a carbon tax, but the way it looks to me, it can't really be thought of a tax. When I think of a tax, I think of some kind of imposition applied to all taxpayers, and that's not what's happening here. What's happening here is there is a price being levied as a kind of penalty against some 300 major companies who are making their profits out of the process of generating carbon dioxide. I think in particular of fossil fuel power companies, aluminium smelters, iron ore type processing industries. And these people are being required to pay into a central fund an amount of $23 per tonne of carbon dioxide emitted. And the interesting thing about this is that this fund fairly soon builds up to a substantial amount, and the fund is used to compensate householders for any price rise that they experience as a result of this mechanism. For example, electricity suppliers will probably have to put their prices up to help cover the cost of the $23 a tonne. And that householders who do cop this price rise are being paid out of the fund to recompense them for that price increase. And it appears also that from this fund, the government will be in a position to invest in cleaner energy technologies that will also help towards the reduction in the levels of carbon dioxide emitted. So it looks like a promising idea, and it might even work. My own thinking was that this sort of thing was probably going to be a long time coming, and that by doing what I did personally here on top of a hill at Lexton, I have provided myself with a comfortable home. It is not dependent on carbon dioxide emissions from anywhere else, and it is in fact a zero emissions house. When the permits were issued, the analysis of the plan suggested that it qualified for an allocation of 9 stars on that particular rating scheme. Not that I was much interested in stars, I was more interested in a comfortable house to retire into.
Which we're all going to need, and I could see this as kind of a model, an inspiration for the building industry to do better around the world, because we're going to have to live without the fossil fuels. That's pretty obvious. We've been listening to John Morgan from Lexton in rural Victoria in southeastern Australia. He's built a 9-star house, an advanced eco-friendly home that could inspire better building around the world. Thank you for sharing with us, John.
I am delighted to meet you, Alex.
I am Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. You can download our programs from our website, ecoshock.org. We are out of time. I'm Alex Smith, thanking you for accompanying me on this hard journey. May we meet in a better world.
It is perhaps a trait of human nature to act only when the worst happens. But that is not a trait we can afford to rely on here. Once the worst does happen, I'm afraid, for this time around, it will be too late to act at all.